Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean,
these comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
But I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Democracy Sausage with me, Mark Kenny, from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute. And perhaps now's a good time to mention our Australia and the World annual lecture. I'm delighted to say this is coming up on Wednesday, September 30th. So if you're listening to this podcast before then, and you may in fact be listening to it later, but if you are listening to it before then, can I alert you to the fact that this year, for the first time, this will be broadcast live on ABC TV and Sky. So wherever you are around the country, you'll be able to watch this important lecture, which is being given by the universally admired Indigenous elder and tireless administrator, leader and public advocate, Pat Turner AM. She's titled her lecture, The Long Cry of Indigenous Peoples to be Heard, a Defining Moment in Australia. And I think it promises to be a really important lecture. Here after altogether, we had the rather too swift dismissal of the Uluru Statement from the Heart in 2017. And this year, when Ms. Turner has been so instrumental in leading and redrafting the expansion of Closing the Gap targets, and of course, the Black Lives Matter movement has surged to the fore this year as well, I can't think of a more urgent, more constructive national project than the one she's going to be talking about. So that's Pat Turner at the National Press Club, lunchtime this week on Wednesday. So now to today, where we have a perspicacious panel to discuss the politics of pandemics and recovery. And we'll even get to voter attitudes in the ACT election, which is coming up on October 17. And Dr. Maria Taflaga from the School of Politics and International Relations. That's also the day, it strikes me just now, of the New Zealand election, which we've discussed on this podcast before. So we must remember to check in on that race sometime in the next fortnight
or
so.
Yes, we do.
Always very interesting to hear what's happening in New Zealand politics, where Jacinda Ardern, certainly from outward appearances, has been the dominant figure. And, of course, there's been chaos on the other side of politics. I think they've now had three opposition leaders, which is not what you'd call the ideal preparation going into an election.
No, and I think they've actually had three this year, which is an impressive feat, even for a sort of slightly more chaotic party system in New Zealand. And I think the current incumbent opposition leader, whose name actually completely escapes me, how terrible.
Well, I think it probably completely escapes most voters. So it's entirely justified that someone on this side of the ditch, as they call it, is not remembering, and I'm not remembering it either. But as you say, with such a rapid turnover, three opposition leaders in 1 year, it's hardly surprising, and that doesn't really position her well.
No, she's an ex-police officer as well. So it is a sort of the two major parties are both represented by women, which would be an interesting, and I think it is a first in New Zealand politics as well, to have the two major prime ministerial candidates be women. So it'll be an exciting election for many reasons.
Isn't it interesting, though, that is that situation where there is two women sort of contesting the prime ministership? And this is a country that is now on its third female prime minister, which is also, suggests that in some ways their political culture is more advanced than ours.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we can kind of point directly to just the changes that have been made to the party system in New Zealand, which generally mean that you have more parties in the mix, and that is generally correlated with more female candidates generally. So that doesn't surprise me, but I think it also goes to what Jacinda Ardern said to, I think, Julia Gillard in her latest book, which was that, yeah, it did actually matter that there had been female leaders before her, and that it made a big difference, even if she was the first to be a mother or to give birth in the role.
And, of course, we're sitting here in the ACT where there's been certainly a female chief minister, there have been a few of them, but it's only one day after the sad news of the passing of former Labor Minister Senator Susan Ryan. And, indeed, she was senator for the ACT, an absolute trailblazing feminist who was responsible for the Sex Discrimination Act and was a great champion of women's rights all through her career. But also she was, as I say, the first female Labor minister federally, which is groundbreaking in itself.
She was instrumental, actually, to getting women onto the agenda. So Susan Ryan, tried to run for politics a little bit earlier in 1975 from memory. And she wasn't able to win that vote, but she impressed a lot of the sort of factional heavies, I suppose you'd call them then, by coordinating all of these women to sort of join the Labor Party, and then effectively acted as kingmaker, picking who did win. And so this brought her to the attention of sort of Labor higher ups. And in that sort of led to her becoming effectively like an advisor to the Federal Council on Women's Policy. And in that role, she essentially argued that women should be sort of central rather than just some random appendage to Labor's agenda. And she was really crucial, actually, in sort of seeing that decline in the Liberal share of the women's vote, which had until that time been, you know, absolutely dominant. So Susan Ryan's legacy, not only as Age Discrimination Commissioner, not only in bringing forward the Sex Discrimination Act, was really quite a profound one for how we live today. And so, yeah, we should all just take a small moment to thank her for that.
Yeah, indeed we should. And she was, of course, also Education Minister, which was an even bigger ministry relative to other portfolios than it is today, as I understand it. And she presided over in that portfolio through a period when there was quite a deal of reform, including massive expansion, really, of the university sector, and, you know, higher retention rates of schools, which then fed into the university sector, and which, of course, John Dawkins, subsequent minister, presided over those changes to introduce the Higher Education Contribution Scheme.
Which we know as HECS.
Which we know as HECS, and which some people hate, but which nonetheless had at its heart the idea that you would only pay for your education when you achieved a certain level of income that you could afford to pay it back. So some people would have continued on with free education, particularly those who didn't finish.
Yeah, a lot of people serving in politics right now, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
Just make that point.
So also with us is Emeritus Professor John Warhurst, also from the School of Politics and International Relations. He's a particular favourite of Democracy Sausage. John, welcome back from a remote location down the coast.
Thanks, Mark. It's a pleasure. Can I also just mention, among the things that Susan Ryan did, she was deputy chair of the Australian Republican Movement, and I worked with her in that movement, and it just shows how wide her influence was in very many community groups over her lifetime.
That's a really good point to make, actually, John, because I was listening to Wendy McCarthy and former Governor General Quentin Bryce, both very great friends of Susan Ryan, talking with Geraldine Doogue, another friend of Susan Ryan this morning. They're really only talking, you know, a day after she suddenly passed away after, coming out of the surf. She was swimming and collapses and it ends rather quickly, and it's very shocking to everyone. But the points that particularly Wendy McCarthy was making, I think that Susan Ryan was not just someone with a great work ethic, but someone with a real flair for bringing people along, for building a community around an idea and really sort of drawing others into action as well. And that's a great attribute, I think, particularly for someone interested in reform. And she has had a very proud record of reform that she could point to. And finally, Sarah Eisen. Now, Sarah Eisen is a political correspondent with The West Australian. It's welcome back to you, Sarah, because you also have been on Democracy Sausage before, and you're just, I guess, lining up somewhat nervously for your first budget.
Yeah, next week's going to be a big one, and a very different one for everyone, even those people who've done many budgets for years. It's going to look completely different because of COVID-19.
Yeah, well, I think I worked out that I'd done 15 or 16 of these lockups, and there's not going to be the same sort of lockup this year because it's the opposite thing that you would do with COVID is to put everyone in these airless rooms for 8 hours or 6 hours and feed them
sandwiches.
Bad sandwiches and have them all, you know, stale biscuits and have everyone sort of leaning into everyone else and whispering and working
away. Making sure
away
you're on the right track, for sure. And now it's going to be a reduced time frame as well, and it's going to be one of, you know, the most historically significant budgets probably in quite some time, but in a reduced time frame, not having your peers around you kind of thing. So it's going to be really interesting, definitely nerve-wracking and daunting, I can say that. But
it's
really
a good point you make about the peers, because one of the things that journalists who work in the gallery where I've worked for so long know is that when you have the budget lockup, you get the hierarchy from your media organisation. If it's a newspaper, you know, it'll be the editor and a whole bunch of others. Senior people will come to Canberra. And so there's an interesting dynamic that happens on the day. You're in there with all of these people you often deal with on the phone quite a lot, but in some cases have never even seen if you're a Canberra correspondent. Mm-hmm. And there's a vast number of people in these places. You know, the Australian has a whole room to itself virtually or nearly. There are hundreds of people from all these different media organisations, and it's a kind of, I don't know, it's hard to describe. It's sort of low oxygen after a while because it's not particularly well ventilated, as I say, exactly what you don't want in a COVID situation.
It's like a quiet library exam festival.
It is. It has the kind of threatening atmosphere of an exam, in the sense that, you know, there's a certain amount of risk of what you miss, you know, so there's a lot of anxiety there. You can almost cut it with a knife.
Yeah.
And the clock's ticking down, but you're there from 1:30 or 2 o'clock when you go in until 7:30
exactly.
When the treasurer gets to his or her feet, in this case his feet, at the dispatch box to deliver the budget, at which point everyone's let out, but, you know, they've already written their copy and that's the way it works. Well, it's going to be different this year.
Yeah, wish me luck.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be doing a bit of it myself, actually.
Yeah.
But but as you say, it'll be different. It's not going to be everyone together. All the bureaus are going to be separately doing their thing, but there'll be confidentiality provisions in exactly the same way. So.
Yeah.
But it will be a lower key affair. I think what's more interesting about it, though, is the budget itself. I mean, this is a dramatically different situation from that which anyone expected, of course. And we've got a government that's really gone through, Maria, quite a shapeshift in order to deal with this. We've had the treasurer last week making the point in a big speech that it's going to be all about jobs. It's going to have two phases, but the first phase of the government policy, which, let's face it, will take it past the next election, likely to be around this time next year, but even if it's a bit later, we're talking about a government that's saying it's all going to be about jobs and stimulus for the economy, on promoting growth, not about budget repair, even though the budget is in a deeper state of deficit than we've ever seen.
Yeah, and this is reassuring to hear, really, because, of course, one of the easiest ways to repair the budget, and I'm not suggesting this is not going to take decades, is effectively to grow the economy because that increases your tax take, and it also just increases the amount of wealth the country generates, and it means that your debt is a lower proportion of that, which makes it easier to pay off without having to sort of rejig and cut services. But I think, Mark, what you're really alluding to is, I guess, the sort of major sort of psychological and rhetorical shift of the government, which of course gave us the wonderful debt and deficit disaster, which is a fun tongue twister, say that 20 times. And, you know, to now moving on to sort of ignoring the deficit to focus on returning back to normal. And this is, frankly, I think reassuring because the alternative, it would just be completely bonkers. So without wanting to like overly congratulate the government for doing something innately sensible, it is a relief, I'm sure, to all of us.
John, governments in the past, when they've been faced with situations of big deficits, either as new governments or in the aftermath of, downturns, recessions, however you want to describe them, have engaged in quite, particularly conservative governments, have engaged in quite aggressive austerity programs. We've seen that in a number of different countries. That's what's different here, isn't it? This government is signalling right up front there isn't going to be an austerity program, at least not a severe one. It's all going to be about, as Maria said, down the track trying to have growth do the budget repair rather than severe spending cuts. But in the meantime, political logic but also economic logic suggests that the government's just going to have to be intervening very strongly in the market. We already know the economy's 6% smaller than it was. That's the latest economic information that's come out of the Bureau of Statistics. So the government's really doing the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's right, Mark. I mean, I suppose speaking from a university, we are aware of a little bit of austerity coming our way.
Good point.
And also JobKeeper and JobSeeker, I suppose there's element of winding back of those programs. But in terms of getting the economy back on track, it does seem to be a different sort of approach from a conservative government. Like Maria, I think it's welcome. What it says about the government's ideological position, I think, is not immediately obvious to me, because I think the ways we look at it as observers of politics, backflips or full-blown Keynesianism, these are categories that perhaps don't mean as much to the average voter. And I think some of what we're seeing perhaps is, if it just seems sensible to the average person in the street, then that's a good thing. And I was just finished reading Catherine Murphy's The End of Certainty, Scott Morrison's And Pandemic Politics, and that left me even more confused about just where to put not Catherine's analysis, but what she had to say about Scott Morrison and his refusal.
Well, one of the things she said, John, was that the more you look at Scott Morrison, the less you think you know. Yeah. I mean, that was actually one of the comments she made.
That's certainly true with me. You know, the mix of faith and his marketing background and his refusal to see even to accept the term bipartisanship, but rather just to see it as government in action or pragmatic government meeting the needs of the community as he sees them at the time. So.
I think he just uses that as a clever device.
There's a lot that's interesting going on. It's just how you describe it, which I'm not sure about at the moment. And perhaps we shouldn't worry about descriptions too much and just see how it all works out.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, Sarah. What John's referring to there in terms of Morrison resisting the labelling of being progressive. In fact, at one point in that essay, the Catherine Murphy quarterly essay, Morrison's quoted as saying something along the lines of, you know, progressives misread our intervention into the economy. We're spending this money not because we've suddenly, become something we're not. We're doing what needs to be done in the interests of the economy. And I think that tells you a fair bit about Scott Morrison. Everyone's making this point that he's more pragmatic than perhaps he was expected to be. He's less of an ideologue than some of his predecessors. But he's also very as John said, he has a marketing background and he's very conscious of how he's packaged up. And it's like he wants to do both things here. He knows he needs to use the budget to protect the economy, but he's also talking to his party room. He doesn't want to be seen as some sort of new version of Malcolm Turnbull or some sort of moderate. He wants to be seen as essentially mainstream liberal. So he's doing what needs to be done, but resists even praise from, you know, what you might call the centre left for becoming, as John said, a sort of a, you know, new Keynesian.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whenever he kind of fronts the press and has different questions about, you know, straying from or flipping ideologically or anything like that, there's a really quick shutdown to this is beyond politics. We're in a time where this it's not about politics, it's not about ideology. And that's something that I think I've heard like dozens of times in the last few months. And it's really interesting to hear that. And I think the cut through with people watching would be quite high. I think John nailed it regarding what people actually care about. And to hear a politician go, no, we're not going to talk about ideology. I just want to talk about what's going to get done. You know, I think that does hold weight for people, especially when those words are followed through with, you know, big spending, big policy, things like that. I do find it really interesting, you know, like I said, in presses when you could start talking ideology and politics, just shut it down immediately. Just not moving on, next question kind of thing. And I find that a really interesting tactic. And I wonder what people watching who aren't, you know, directly in the press pact, how they see that. I imagine, as I said, it would have quite a lot of cut through.
Well, I think it's a very clever political rhetorical device because, you know, he says he's non-ideological. He says it's all about pragmatism, you know, looking at what works. And, you know, and there's a degree of that in the design of JobKeeper and JobSeeker and so forth. But what he's actually really saying is, or what he's trying to signal is, my position is neutral. And so therefore, if it is neutral, it is not dangerous. And what this does for him is to create sort of space for himself in terms of decisions that he might make that are radical internally within his own party. But it also allows him to kind of cast these other decisions that he's making for the public that might make them a bit nervous. For example, this bank lending scheme where they're going to loosen the controls. You know, again, like, well, you know, this is just something that we have to do. But if we actually look at what the coalition has proposed, apart from their emergency measures, and I think that's important, they are emergency responses. They all reflect the Liberal Party's worldview, and of course they should, right? Because they are a party of the centre right. So, you know, their focus on jobs rather than wage subsidies, the focus on increasing or reducing lending standards to promote, you know, investment. The fact that we've got this sort of gas intervention thing, which is definitely one strand perhaps of an older form of Liberal Party thinking that links back to nationhood, nation building, which John might be interested in talking about. But I think what is going to be very difficult for the government going forward is the conversations we've been having for a very long time. You know, we spend a lot of money, we spend a lot of taxpayers' money on subsidizing these sort of intergenerational differences in who's sort of benefiting from the tax system. So, you know, franking credits comes to mind, but so does just frankly the way we tax savings, the most obvious one being negative gearing. And if we're going to talk about austerity, given we have one of the world's most targeted welfare schemes, like there's not that much fat there. Mm. So does this mean the government wants to go there talking about taking away stuff from its own constituents? Will it have to do that? I don't know. But it's also just going to have to spend a lot more on public services because, you know, old people are also their voters and it is a scandal. It's a national scandal. So it'd be interesting to see how the budget speech itself is rhetorically kind of framed and what is the long-term plan? Like, what does the government consider to be long-term? How are they going to set those parameters for themselves?
Well, John, I wonder whether their long-term plan is their preoccupation at the moment or perhaps the shorter-term plan of getting through the next election is. If you're a government, as we saw in 2008-09, if you're a government that's handing money directly to voters, then you're unlikely to be unpopular for that. And this government's been, you know, reasonably well received around the place for the coordination that it's brought to the COVID response and all of that extra spending that's gone into the economy. This budget's going to be about continuing that in another form. I mean, as you said, your JobKeeper and JobSeeker are being sort of wound down or at least trimmed down. In the case of JobSeeker, we'll see what happens to even the trimmed down version at the end of the year, but there's no promises being made at the moment. It's a lot of unemployed people, so there's some political significance in all of that. But won't really its logic be about keeping as much intervention as it can get in the economy, clever as it will like to make it, so that it can, you know, get to the next election and prevail?
I think the next, you're right, Mark. I think the next election is front of mind, as it is for, you know, for most political leaders. Scott Morrison might talk about long-term issues, but the most important issue for him, I think, is, well, firstly, consolidating his own position as Prime Minister. We forget how, you know, previous Prime Ministers have come and gone very quickly, and I think his first job was to establish himself as a long-term Liberal leader, and secondly, to do that by winning the next election. And I think the sort of pragmatism exhibited by Scott Morrison is first and foremost a fairly immediate sort of pragmatism, and I suppose that's the meaning of the term pragmatism in a way. You're dealing with the circumstances in front of you, and I think over the next 18 months or so, he'll be doing everything, as you would expect, to make sure he comes out on top at the next election. I think that means two things, to pick up on Maria's point about he's playing to his own party and his own backbench, and I think he's happy not to be categorised for that reason, because as soon as he's categorised or branded as a particular sort of Liberal, he'll upset someone in his own backbench or even in his ministry, and he has to avoid that because that's what brought down previous Liberal leaders. And secondly, I think it makes it extraordinarily difficult for the opposition to know how to respond to Scott Morrison's various measures, partly because I think it was Joel Fitzgibbon who was saying, well, Scott Morrison's stolen some of Labor's policies, where at the same time, you know, Mark Butler was objecting to the new version of energy policy. So I think it holds Scott Morrison in pretty good stead for the next election if he's quietening down the people behind him in his own party, while at the same time making life difficult to get a coherent response out of Labor, who don't really know whether to cheer him for some of his new directions or to continue to nail him as, you know, not doing enough in terms of economic stimulus or really not doing enough in the energy space either. I think Scott Morrison has got both his adversaries, the ones on his own side and the ones on the opposition, pretty much in check just at the moment.
That's a really good observation. Let's take a quick break there and come back and continue this discussion in just a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Just before the break, John, you were talking about Scott Morrison having potential critics in his own side and, of course, the natural critics that he has on the other side of the parliament, having them both in a position probably close to where he wants them at the moment, which is you know, sort of not in a very powerful position and to some extent divided. Nonetheless, we've seen his government actually walk away from some things that the coalition's been known for a long time. I mean, we saw midweek last week the announcement that the NBN is going to now do fibre to the premises. Now, this was a political, you know, war really over a decade about how Labor's plan was, you know, gold plated and it cost too much and everything else. And that it was building capacity that didn't need to be there. I think at one stage Tony Abbott described it as a, when all said and done, just something for downloading movies. And of course COVID's come along and shown the shortcomings of the system. So we've seen the NBN company now preparing to spend $4.5 billion, and let's face it, it could well be more, connecting up 8 million premises to fibre all the way to the premises. We've also seen Scott Morrison, the man who waved a lump of coal around in Parliament, adopt gas a couple of weeks ago, and then last week his energy minister, Angus Taylor, announces these five areas where they're going to use public funds to essentially favour these potential technologies aimed at getting emissions down. They won't name a 2050 zero emissions target, but they say out of the side of their mouth they think they'll get there anyway. So you've got, and you put that, combine that with the budget, you've got some pretty big areas where the coalition has kind of, I think you could argue, taken a step to the centre. Now, voters might not care about that per se, but it does represent a quite significant shapeshift on behalf of the government. Don't you agree, Maria?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think Scott Morrison has, I think since the bushfires and perhaps a bit earlier, kind of recognised that the politics of climate and the environment is getting more and more difficult as their blue ribbon heartlands want action on climate change as their major constituency, the business community, needs a policy framework to make investment decisions, but they're sort of still making coalitions to govern based on regional voters where the Nationals are pursuing a very different kind of politics. But I think you can view some of these things in a very political lens, like in relation to the NBN. One of the things that I actually would really like to understand, because I don't know the answer to it, is, you know, what is driving this decision about upgrading the network? Like, is it?
It needs to be upgraded. I mean, the very reason that Labor was proposing to do it in the first place has been accepted by the government. That's the long and the short of it. They'll shilly-shally around this, and the CEO of NBN Co. says, well, what we're doing is we're using income from having now completed the build of, you know, using copper to the home as the last bit. We're getting income from it. We're turning some of that income back into upgrading, and this is the right way to go. That's half an argument, I think. It doesn't actually explain why they didn't just tell us that was their strategy in the first place.
Well, it clearly wasn't their strategy in the first place, I think. Or, they're very – I don't see why you would keep that sort of secret. I mean, but is it just because, you know, eventually there's a long-term ambition to sell this network and it would just be more valuable? I don't know.
But even if it would be more valuable, it would be more valuable because it works.
Well, yes. That does seem to be important. But I think what is actually kind of important to sort of think about when we ask all of these questions about what the government is doing is, well, you know, let's we hear what they say, but what is the actual question they've asked? So what questions are the government asking or setting itself to answer? Okay. A lot of them seem to be kind of political questions, which relate to how do I solve the problem of the climate wars within the internal politics of my political party? How do I satisfy voters that I'm actually doing something on climate, given that this issue is only getting more salient? You know, how will I win the next election? Policy questions sound a bit different, you know, like what will underpin Australia's future prosperity in a world of change? How will we get there? And like, how will we know that they have succeeded? You know, I hear less on the latter set of questions. And at the moment, we're still hearing a lot more in the sort of political set of questions. And I guess that reflects the fact that this government didn't expect to win the last election. And so it didn't.
Well, if it wasn't for COVID, it wouldn't have had an agenda, really. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, it had very little to do other than get tax cuts through, which it did.
Exactly.
And then the bushfires came along and then COVID, and it really has, you know, changed the challenge for everyone, which is not to dismiss you know, some of the extraordinary work that has been done. But it is interesting to think that it was a pretty empty sort of agenda, Sarah, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think it's really interesting to see, you know, in this COVID world exactly how the government has reacted. I, you know, have heard from Scott Morrison and Frydenberg words I never thought I'd hear from the coalition regarding social safety nets and things like that that are just really, you know, it's unprecedented. It's interesting. It does, you know, always beg the question in the parallel universe where COVID never happened, where we'd be now, what would be, you know, being addressed and so on. Because it just seems like so much is being triggered or at least pushed along by COVID. I think you mentioned, Mark, during this time, how much we've seen how inadequate the sort of the NBN and internet in general has been. There's been a lot of stories from different journalists about a lot of these issues and the working from home culture, how that's pushed things along. So I just think it's really such an interesting time where things have been either triggered or sped up and what that means for the long term. I mean, no one can say, but it's going to be interesting to see.
It certainly is.
Mark, it's interesting that these two areas we're speaking about are ones that are very close to Malcolm Turnbull's heart. And I seem to have, he's been given a bit of a fresh voice over the last week or so. And I imagine he'll continue to speak out on these issues. Even get Tony Abbott springing to the defence of his own government, which I don't think Scott Morrison would welcome that replay of the Abbott Turnbull debate.
So that would be neither non-ideological or pragmatic.
Yeah, I think you're right there, and it's a good point you make about former prime ministers because we've had a few of them out actually.
Yeah, I was just about to say
Paul Keating out criticising the Reserve Bank for not doing enough to put liquidity into the economy, saying that it should essentially be buying government bonds at a much higher rate or printing money. Mm. We've had Malcolm Turnbull calling the energy plan and the gas part of it crazy.
Yep, see.
And we've of course had Kevin Rudd claiming vindication for you know for the NBN decision. You know, saying, well, what was all the bloody
fuss
about?
There's a lot of former PMs out. Yeah, I've noticed that looking at the TVs half the time, going, oh, another former PM. I think Keating was just on this morning. I saw on one of the channels as well. So.
Yeah, he was talking about Susan Ryan.
But like I'm hearing so much from these different leaders and their two cents on different things. It's such an interesting time. It's such a I don't know, like a melting pot where there's all this policy that former leaders are weighing in on and giving their two cents on or saying, hey, I was right about this or you know, yeah, it's interesting.
Keating on aged care too. I mean, he's really having a good run at the moment.
Yeah, yes.
I think what it just sort of says is that, well, you know, we are seeing the end of the politics of prosperity, which is pretty much all we can really remember if you really think about it. Mm. And the second is that the decisions that people will be making right now actually really, really do matter because it's not guaranteed that huge revenue windfalls will be coming to sort of wash out poor decisions that might be made because there'll be enough money to go around that most people won't notice.
Mm. Yeah, well, and you mentioned one of them before, franking credits. I mean, it was a bad policy that was essentially obscured by the resources boom. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, John Howard introduces a policy to effectively end, you know, they'd first had the end of double taxation and then Howard comes along and ends any taxation for this particular class of investment. And that is utterly atrocious policy. And yet it's baked into the economy now. And the reason it was able to be baked in, as you say, Maria, and you put it very well, you know, it was essentially sort of washed over by the rivers of gold that were coming from the resources boom in the early 2000s.
Yeah, which is the point people, I guess, like to make about the two Howard governments, which I think is a bit of a simplistic argument. But that idea that the first sort of two Howard governments were in a sort of resource constrained environment, they had to make trade-offs, they had to make difficult decisions. The second last two Howard governments basically just sort of, you know, rolling in a once in a century mining boom, which I think we need to kind of, you need to look at a graph of this. The last time we had a boom like this was the 1880s. So that's how long it takes to get another boom of that scale.
I remember seeing the Treasurer Peter Costello come into the Blue Room at Parliament House a number of times with those, you know, mid-year economic financial outlooks and other key economic moments where income from resources, royalties from iron ore and other things were just, you know, had been vastly underestimated, and now there was an extra 16 or, you know, whatever it was, billion dollars that has just suddenly shown up in the budget. I mean, we're in exactly the opposite terrain now.
Precisely.
It's bringing some quite interesting political responses. Mm. Sarah, what's your, just quickly before we leave this, what's your assessment of where the opposition is? It's a difficult time to be in opposition.
Yeah, I think it is a really difficult time, and it's been that fight for relevancy, and especially early, like this year, it's about, you can't be seen, I think, as the opposition to be slowing things down or being obstructive, but also, you know, then trying to stay relevant, but then also trying to, you know, you had earlier this year Albo in hard hats going, you know, we like the mining and coal towns. I feel like they're trying to do everything, and by doing that, I'm not sure if they're doing anything of really like substance and clarity kind of thing for people to really understand what they're about. And I mean, that's also something that's frustrating, I think, in the press gallery, is when you do try to shore that up and have any level of clarity, it's so often, well, we'll let you know at the end of the year, you know, with the conference or whatever, which is difficult. In this year has been so pivotal and so important that at a time when it's so important, I think, to be really clear and really solid on where you stand, where you would go, what you would do, they're going, oh, we'll let you know at the end of the year. And I think that kind of works against them.
Yeah, that's a really difficult position to be in. I understand it, though, from a kind of a strategic point of view. They're burnt by the fact that they put so much policy into the electoral marketplace before the last election. They need to be careful not to overreact to that and go too far the other way, because they, as you say, they end up sort of not having anything to say all the time, because they're always about down the track to announce whatever their policy is.
Mm.
You know, this is one of the things that Christine Wallace noted in her book, How to Win an Election. She said that Labor had overlearnt the lesson of instability in the period that Shorten was the leader, and had sort of overcorrected to the point of going for stability above all else, rather than having proper debates about some of the things, which is why they ended up with franking credit policy and other things that were difficult to explain, and there was too much of it and all that sort of stuff. I think they need to be careful now that they don't overreact to what happened in the 2019 poll and leave everything, you know, go for the, you know, the old traditional small target strategy and kind of not have anything to say. That said, they should be given credit for having put into the public realm some of the things that this government has actually successfully done during this COVID period, the key one being, of course, JobKeeper. I mean, they didn't come up with that name, but they did very strongly call for wage subsidies. And, you know, the government initially rejected that, and then when it saw those unemployment queues, suddenly realised, wow, we've got a major problem on our hands, and the vision of those queues snaking around the corner of people sitting on milk crates and just the dislocation of that, I think it sent shudders straight through the government, and it realised we have to do some really big things. And there have been a few other examples as well. But it's a difficult time to be in opposition.
Yeah, I think extremely difficult. Yeah.
Oh, the world is revolutionising itself roughly every 28 days right now. I think the opposition has done quite well with what is, if we were to think about it in card playing terms, a pretty rubbish hand. So, I think that ultimately, even though it is sort of, I guess, frustrating for people who are engaged, I can kind of see the wisdom of seeing what kind of terrain the government is going to set itself up to fight an election, and then for the opposition to sort of respond to the terrain on the day rather than what they think it might be now, given that the world is changing so rapidly. I would also just posit that they don't know. Which is why they're telling you, we'll tell you later.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. There's an interesting test coming up because what the budget does do is it allows the government to outline where it's going. And this, you know, people tell me from close to the decision makers that there's going to be a lot in this budget. There's going to be some announcements this week. They're keen to keep the momentum rolling up to the budget. This is the government, and there'll be a fair bit in the budget. One of the reasons why some of the things like statement they're going for a jobs first policy rather than budget repair. Mm. One of the reasons they put that story out there is because they were very conscious that it was something that would get lost on budget day by virtue of all of the other things that are going to be in the budget. So it's quite telling when you sort of deconstruct when, and I'd advise this to anyone listening, if you're sort of wanting to get a sense of what the budget's, how big the budget is going to be, look at the amount of noise you hear about it beforehand from the government. And if they're releasing what appear to be quite big things, it means there are even bigger things coming in the budget. They generally don't tread on their own lead, as we say in journalism, by releasing it all first and then having nothing to say on budget day. For Labor, however, there's also the budget reply speech that comes on the Thursday evening. And that is beamed into the lounge rooms of Australia for those people who switch on and watch. And it is seen by the opposition as a big chance to make some fairly clear statements of values about where they stand in the current political economy. And I think we'll get a bit of guidance as to how well Albanese is able to, I guess, put together a narrative and sell that. It's being seen by Labor as a pretty pivotal moment. A fair bit of pressure on the opposition leader, but an opportunity as well.
Mark, I think Anthony Albanese has to take that opportunity. I mean, whatever about keeping your powder dry on policy, you can't deal yourself out of the public space altogether. And I think they really do have to take a stand there. I think Jim Chalmers, an ANU graduate, I should say, has been battling away pretty well and has got quite a bit of, commentary and publicity. But Anthony Albanese really has to nail it in the budget reply speech.
That's a very wise observation to make, John, about Labor. Now, before we go, let's talk about voting advice applications. Now, some of you will know what they are, others won't, but you'll all have heard of Vote Compass, for example. Some of you may have seen Smart Vote at the last election. Both of these are what's called voting advice applications, and Smart Vote is one that is being pursued and being rolled out for the ACT election, which is currently underway, as I mentioned at the top of the show. What is Smart Vote? How does it work? How does it differ from Vote Compass? And why do we, why are we interested in these sorts of things, Maria? You're involved in this research project, as indeed am I, as indeed is John. So I just thought let's talk about what VAAs are and why we do them, because it's really quite interesting. Essentially, let me frame it and then you can add to it. Essentially, what it is a situation where a voter can go onto the website, can fill in answers to a range of questions. I think there's about 35. And the program will match your answers to candidates. That's what's different between Smart Vote and Vote Compass. Vote Compass matches you to a party. This is, we would argue, a level of sophistication a bit deeper where it matches you to an individual candidate because the candidates have filled out the surveys themselves and they've also filled out, in some cases, additional comments. And it provides some very interesting results. I mean, you may find yourself answering questions about the economy in one way. You may be answering some social policy questions in the other. You may be quite progressive on the environment, but also quite socially conservative, whatever it is. And Smart Vote will tell you who is the candidate best suited to you. And it's really quite a fascinating thing, but it's also interesting to study because it gives us a whole lot of information and enriches the democratic process.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what has been really encouraging about the ACT election is that, as far as I understand, the political parties have actually allowed their candidates to fill out these forms themselves, which is a sort of perennial kind of problem.
Because they tend to be risk averse during – political parties tend to be risk averse during election campaigns and they try and sort of have a stock answer for all their candidates.
Exactly. And so at the last federal election when we used Smart Vote, we found less variation amongst lower house candidates, but we did have a lot more variation amongst Senate candidates. So the voting advice application, particularly given there were like a billion candidates on the Senate ballot, especially if you did not live in the ACT, it was very good to kind of navigate the sort of kaleidoscope of political parties to help you pick them out. And I guess what is the way Smart Vote tells you where you are is that it has multiple dimensions, as Mark alluded to, sort of social policy, economic policy, environmental policy, and it will essentially map those for you to look like a spider web, and you can effectively sort of see where you kind of match up with candidates. And so, for example, perhaps you might match up very closely with a candidate on social issues, but that might not be the thing you really care about. You might match up more closely on economic issues. And so even though there might be slightly more variation between you and candidate B, for example, you care about those issues more. And so you should be voting for candidate B, particularly in a situation like the ACT where there's actually more than one candidate running for each seat. So it's a multi-member district. So there are actually four Labor candidates to pick from, or however many it is. And you know, not all Labor candidates or Liberal candidates are alike, are they?
That's right. And it puts candidates, minor party and independent candidates, on a level playing field with party candidates.
Exactly.
You know, we know party candidates in Australian elections have a big advantage. They already have a presence in the marketplace. People are less interested in the individuals, more interested in the parties, particularly if they're loyal coalition or Labor voters or Greens voters or whatever. But what this does, if you fill it in, and you don't have to fill in every question either. There may be, you may decide not to fill in some questions, which it factors in and understands that you don't wish to be mapped on that basis. Or they may just be issues about which you have no interest in and wouldn't turn you from a candidate to another anyway. John, it's really fascinating to look at these sorts of applications, particularly in light of what we've seen has been a fairly steady erosion of loyalty in the major party blocks. You know, from the old days when, you know, people voted one way because their parents did, and that, you know, that went down through the generations. That's breaking down now. We see more turbulence or more instability in the electoral system. And a thing like a VAA can give you a really interesting, I suppose, exposure to all the different candidates and tell us a lot about what people are, what is actually making them vote in elections and why.
Yeah, it's an amazing exercise. I mean, I would recommend it to anyone in that it expands your vision of the range of issues. I mean, the 32 or 35 questions are only a small sample of you know, 100 possible questions which might have been asked, and it shows you how wide the field of policy is for a voter approaching an election. So I think it's a great empowerment tool for voters. And as you said, at a time when party identification appears to be dropping away, and there's also dissatisfaction with centralized party machines and trust in government generally. So I think it throws a really important new tool into the mix. It doesn't actually predict how you're going to vote. I mean, you might find that you line up with a particular candidate or with a particular party, and you decide, no, for other reasons, strategic reasons, I'm going to put my vote elsewhere. But at least it expands the options before you when you're go into the ballot box.
And how those questions are designed is quite important, isn't it? We've put a lot of effort into designing that questionnaire so that it's not just a simple case of, you know, writing yes, yes, yes to a whole series. If you did that, it would, because of the way the questions have been asked and because they are designed to effectively reflect differences between the parties and the candidates, it's not just any old bunch of questions. It's a very carefully designed process so that we can have that spider web, as Maria described it, drawn at the end. And some people might be quite fascinated. I say, I thought I was a Labor voter, but I'm actually a Liberal voter in this case.
Yeah, that's entirely possible to sort of happen. So in the case of the ACT Smart Vote, the question set is a little bit different to what you might get at the federal election. You know, public transport, for example, features a bit more strongly in this one than it might say at federal election.
And if you've been a lifelong voter of any colour, you might actually be surprised to know a bit more about that party that you've devoted your life to voting for, and also a bit more about the other options, both the independent options and also the other party options.
Yeah, I mean, a good independent, theoretically, who may not have a lot of public profile but believes he or she is very dialed into their local community may turn out to attract quite a lot of support from this process. You might never have heard of this person who's standing for the seat of Brindabella or whatever it is. You might not have heard of them, but it turns out that your attitudes and that person's match up better than anyone else's. Yeah. And that could be quite instrumental in the election. And that's, to that extent, it's quite enriching in the process.
And I think also, like, obviously this is, you know, the tool you guys have all developed, but just hearing about it, I think even on like a national level, there's so much, I guess, confusion among a lot of my, I guess, friends and so on. When it's all the names all down on, who is that? Who is this? I know maybe which way I probably vote, but I don't know who that is and that is and that is. And there's all these names on a sheet of paper that maybe if you're not really plugged in, you don't actually know who anyone is. You don't know exactly what you're doing, you know, in that sense. And I think that's why these sorts of tools, as you've mentioned, this detail, level of detail and sophistication, you know, for this election coming up and at the territory level, but potentially sort of going forward where we need more of this detail, because I think there's just people get quite overwhelmed and just see dozens and dozens of names maybe on a sheet of paper that they just go, oh, don't know, just gonna just quickly do this, no clue, don't really know what I think or what I think of any of these people. And so in that way, I think the tool is really important and quite significant because of that.
Yeah, particularly if you don't want to vote for a major party for your first vote for whatever reason or at all, it might be useful to work out if the Pirate Party or the Science Party
or the
Sustainable Housing Party, whose names might seem indicatively attractive to you, or the Hemp Party, but whose actually policy preferences are completely insane or completely in line with what your with what you believe the direction that the ACT or the country should go in. Well, this is absolutely the tool for you. It doesn't take very long either. I think you'll be done in about 10 minutes.
Yes. Well, it's being led by Professors Patrick Dumont and Ian McAllister in the School of Politics and International Relations, and a number of others of us are involved as well. And we'd very strongly encourage you, if you are in the ACT, to get on and do that. It's being promoted through and it's accessible through the Canberra Times, and, you know, very much an enriching experience in democracy, and will provide us with valuable research about how people vote and what are the things that, you know, help them form their judgments about their vote. And probably in a system of compulsory voting, there's a lot to be said for any sort of tool that says, okay, well, it's not just about showing up. There's a little bit of quite easy research you can do here, which will provide you with more than just the ability to cast a donkey vote, you know, just straight down the ticket, or to just go with what you did last time and feel unfulfilled about it. You may in fact say, look, I actually feel good about my vote this year because I did that. I worked out something that surprised me, and I've cast a vote for something that I care about. And from a research point of view, that's going to be quite interesting, because there's quite a literature about motivations for voters, and this will be very instructive in adding to that. Can I thank you all for a really tremendous discussion today, Sarah Eisen, Maria Taflaga, John Warhurst, and all of you listening today. It's been terrific to have you along, as always. We'll be back with another Democracy Sausage next week, and I'll be back later in the week with a terrific discussion with Nick Bryant, the BBC correspondent to the US. He's written a wonderful new book, and I think there's a fairly good chance I'll have a very high-profile guest interviewer with me to talk to Nick Bryant, assuming that we get all our ducks in a row and make this thing happen.
Is it Tom Hanks? I hope it's Tom Hanks.
No, but he is an American, or at least he's an American by birth. And Nick Bryant's book is When America Stopped Being Great, I think it's the title of it. And it's he's actually got a PhD in US in American history. So he's a very well-researched person, Nick Bryant. And it's a fabulous book. And, of course, there's all eyes are on the US at the moment with the election underway there, and with seeming fraying of so many things that seemed solid before that are just sort of deteriorating at the moment. So it's a fascinating subject, and we'll look forward to doing that interview and bringing it to you later in the week. Until then, bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.